Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. I was talking to another mom recently. We were both at the playground with our kids, and we started chatting about jobs, and she said, "I used to work in television." And I said, "Oh, were you a producer?" I don't know why I said that, and she answered, "No, I was a reporter." And then she added, "You know, I used to be skinny and look much prettier." It was not a good place to be, right? Awkward. And it made me wonder, did I say producer because I admire producers and I know how hard their job is? Or did I say it because somehow she didn't look like a TV reporter to me? You know, perfect anchor hair, great outfit, lots of makeup, size 4. We have so much information stored in our brains that helps us sort things out. With everything and every person we encounter, we immediately scan the existing files to assign meaning to what we're seeing. It's amazingly helpful, but sometimes that information steers us wrong and we may not even realize it. We jump to conclusions without knowing it. On today's show, we'll explore how we can challenge our assumptions and the transformation that can happen when we do. We'll meet a physician who had to study up on a fake disease in order to really establish trust with her patients.
Everything changes. The dynamics shift because all of a sudden it's like you're speaking in code.
We'll chat with a philosopher who looks for complex minds in animals that are not at all like us.
The majority of their neurons are not found where you'd expect to find them, sort of in the head, between the eyes, as you would with a human, but instead spread through the body.
Think a brain in your arm. And we'll hear from patients who say they are being typecast as drug addicts when really they have a serious illness and need treatment.
I don't take the Vicodin like that, but they don't know me to know that.
Here to start us off with our first story on challenging our assumptions is reporter Tanya English. Hey, Tanya.
Hey, Maiken. So when I say nurse, what comes to mind?
Nurse. Middle-aged, wears scrubs, sensible shoes, caring, hardworking, kind of takes care of business.
Okay, I see all of that. And the nurse that you're imagining, is she a woman?
She is definitely a woman.
Okay, so actually the reality is that that's changing a little bit. Men are a growing minority in nursing, and we all talk about diversity a lot. But beyond political correctness, experts say there's a real value in having more healthcare workers from different backgrounds, and that can lead to better care.
How so?
Well, last year I got to see it firsthand. I spent 2 weeks in the hospital on and off with my husband, and he had a lot of male nurses.
And did you think they delivered different care to him?
I mean, they didn't treat him differently. The way that you give a shot is the same. But nurses do a lot more than just dispense medicine. I mean, they're doing patient education and they're trying to get people to change their health habits. And that takes connection and communication. And all of that is part of the care that nurses give. And so there's a campaign to get more men to choose nursing.
Do the men who are in nursing, what are they up against? Is it strange to be a guy in nursing?
Yeah. I spoke with several nursing students and all of them were guys, and they said they deal with a lot of misconceptions. And the big one is that nursing is a compromise somehow. Let's take a listen.
The thing I hear most often is, "Oh, when are you going to go to med school?" I kind of try to just brush it off.
You hear nurse a lot, and maybe it's still even the word nurse. Like, what is it about that word that has a female connotation to it?
They say, like, "Oh, so you get all the ladies, huh?" I never get, "Oh, you must be really compassionate," or anything like that.
Wow, lots of stereotypes here. And I thought nurse was a man purse and not a male nurse.
Yeah, it's male nurse. You know, that's a really good place to start. And the first thing that we do have to get straight about men in nursing is, what do we call them?
I am not a male nurse. I'm a nurse.
Frank Poliafico is retired these days, but he graduated from nursing school back in 1971. He's stocky with thick black eyebrows, while his mustache and the rest of his hair have gone gray. Poliafico helped integrate the nursing ranks in Philadelphia when maybe 2% of registered nurses were men. He says his patients never had a problem with him when he walked in a room.
You know, even when I worked OBGYN, I worked obstetrics, I never had a woman say, I don't want him in here, he's a man.
But in the 70s, some female co-workers didn't take him seriously.
You know, I've had women attempt to embarrass me with off-color jokes that they wouldn't tell in mixed company, but it's only Frank. And I would hear that statement a lot, it's only Frank.
He was the outsider. But Poliafico says at times his insights as a minority in the workplace helped him give patients better care. In those first years of his career, he was working in a big emergency room in Philadelphia, and part of his job was to care for victims of sexual violence.
And I did a little bit of battle with a group called Women Organize Against Rape, because they didn't think a man should be in charge of the program, number one, and definitely shouldn't be in there with a rape victim.
After an assault, the hospital collected each patient's clothes for forensic evidence. That meant most women went home wearing paper underwear. Poliafico says it was just one more unnecessary indignity. So he went to talk to a social worker.
And she said, I got some money. I said, good. Go buy me a gross of women's underwear assorted sizes. So that when a woman left my ER, she had a pair of women's underwear on. And there were women who were, you know, there for years before me. They didn't think of that.
That's the kind of considerate care we all want. But Poliafico had to prove himself at first. 40 years later, after he first entered nursing, the job is still a tough sell for some men. Workforce researchers say low pay, relative to other professions, and image problems are still barriers. In the traditional bedside jobs, the skill it takes to dress or bathe a patient is the same whether you're a man or a woman. But Professor Brian Fasolka, who teaches at the College of Nursing at Drexel University, says the perception can be different.
When a male nurse goes to provide that same care to a female patient, there's always this concern that the male will be accused of, you know, inappropriately approaching the patient or touching the patient.
As a result, many men choose nursing jobs that don't require intimate contact. Those jobs often pay a lot more. Jobs as a manager, as an ER nurse, or a nurse anesthetist. In a big city with several medical centers, a specially trained nurse anesthetist can easily make $150,000 to $200,000, but that's not the norm in nursing.
So when you look at a profession like nursing that's 90% women, it's really seen as women's work, and it doesn't get the professional status and recognition that it deserves.
He says the gender wage gap in America says a lot about how much we value so-called women's work. Across careers, women still earn just 80 cents for every dollar men earn. With so many nurses around the country getting ready to retire, Brian Fasolka says it just makes sense to use men to fill the need. There's been a steady increase over three decades, but today only about 10 to 12% of nurses are men.
So, Mr. Zimmerman, I have two medications here for you.
On a noisy med-surg floor at Hershey Medical Center in central Pennsylvania, nurse Elikana Injeri says when he became a nurse 10 years ago, all those stereotypes about men in the field were still around, but they didn't follow him to work. He was welcome from the start, and he and the women he works with are teammates. When we met, he was hanging an IV bag of medicine and trying to figure out how to add another one.
So this is my part. This is where the nursing part comes in, because the doctors don't administer medications. They just order them. They don't check compatibility of medications.
Nurses do the safety checks that make sure that the right medication goes to the right patient at the right time in the right dose.
Potassium chloride. And they are both compatible.
Growing up, the nurses he knew were all women. And Jerry is from Kenya.
In a small town that is known as Nyahururu.
When he came to America at age 24 in search of a career, he heard there was a nursing shortage. In 2002, hospitals were recruiting aggressively and giving out signing bonuses. But even then, and Jerry says he couldn't imagine being a nurse.
No, really. It wasn't a male job at all. So I thought that I wanted to become an accountant.
But the thing is, at the core, he's a caregiver. He's a husband, a dad, and at age 7, he became a stand-in parent for his younger brother and sister.
The main thing was I grew up without a mom. My mother passed on when I was very young.
And Jerry's mother died in a hospital, and at the end of her life, nurses were there. Later, somewhere along the way, he remembered that nurturing and realized that he could do it too.
Maybe if I was in a medical profession, I could help people get well and possibly avoid death and avoid suffering.
That's when he decided to go to nursing school.
It's very rewarding. Every time you come, you are either saving a life or making it better for the patient.
Sharon Bethel from Harrisburg was his patient for just a few hours.
I took to him right away, and he has a real sweet spirit and a real good personality.
Good, good, good. So you feel energized to go back home?
I'm excited to go home.
Excited. And,
and Jerry's only job, really, was to pack her up and get her discharged. But he takes a moment to connect.
Do you have any pain? Everything is set up now?
Hey, nothing hurting right now.
All right.
As they talk about refill prescriptions and follow-up appointments, and Jerry drops a little health education into their conversation.
You still smoke?
No. Oh, yeah, okay. Seven.
Okay.
15 months clean. I wish I could have did that earlier.
Yeah, because that COPD and doesn't go well.
In another room down the hall, Kathy Zimmerman has been at her father's bedside for days.
And then I'm just going to hang his antibiotic now.
Her 75-year-old dad is healing from a bowel obstruction. After several surgeries, he has so many scars across his stomach, and Jerry can barely find a place to give him an injection.
Oh, my, oh boy.
Yeah, see?
Oh boy, oh boy.
There's so much.
You're a tough guy, though. You're a trooper, you know?
He's really experienced. He's been around the block, so I think, and Dad feels a lot more secure with him.
There's a strength about in Jerry. Zimmerman says he's a good nurse, but not because he's a man.
It's more about compassion. Compassion and caring.
A national group, the American Assembly for Men in Nursing, wants men to represent 20% of U.S. registered nurses by the year 2020. There are recruitment posters and YouTube videos, and advocates say it's an attempt to take gender out of nursing. The association offers college scholarships and gives awards to the best schools and workplaces for men.
All right, anything else I can do for you before I leave?
That's Tanya English reporting. We're talking about challenging our assumptions on The Pulse today, and we just heard about men breaking into a traditionally female field. Now let's turn to a woman who broke down many barriers to succeed in a male field, astrophysicist Vera Rubin. She changed our understanding of the makeup of the universe when she proved the existence of dark matter, and as a woman doing this kind of work starting in the 1950s, she challenged gender roles and what people thought women could and should accomplish. Rubin died in December, and this week I talked to one of her four children, Princeton geology professor Alan Rubin. He says the obstacles his mother faced in her work were often discussed at home.
I was in middle school, junior high, we called it then, probably around 1975. She was invited to give a lecture to the Washington Philosophical Society, which held its meetings at the Cosmos Club. And in 1975 at the Cosmos Club, women were not allowed to walk through the front door. So there were a lot of dinner time discussions about what she would do. In the end, I think she actually walked through the side door and gave her lecture. I, in the end, was pretty surprised. I think that was uncharacteristic of her to back down to that extent. I was advocating that she walk into the front, up to the front door and tell them she was a man and just walk on through. But I'd say this is the one time that I can really remember where she backed down.
What do you remember her general attitude to be toward those things? When I'm reading about her, it seems to me she would just say, well, that's just silly. It's stupid to treat me differently because I'm a woman. But how did she talk about those things at home, how her male colleagues treated her at times, how there would be no bathroom for a female person? A lot of things, big things and small.
Well, at times she was angry. I think she was very angry at the slow pace of change. She grew up in Philadelphia. She applied to a lot of Penn and Swarthmore, a couple of Philadelphia area schools. At the Swarthmore interview, when she told the woman that she was interested in astronomy, and the woman said, well, what else? She wouldn't take that interest seriously. My mom said, well, she was also interested in art. And the interviewer asked her, well, have you considered a career, drawing astronomical paintings or paintings of astronomical objects? And this sort of turned into a running joke in the family, have you considered painting astronomical objects, kind of thing. So when they're far enough in the past, they turned into something of a running joke. But when they continued into the 70s, it wasn't so funny anymore, I think.
Did you have any sense how extraordinary your mother was when you were a little boy? I mean, I'm imagining you going to elementary school and probably everybody else's mom at that point, or a lot of them were stay-at-home moms, right?
Probably, but the answer is no. I didn't understand until I left home just what sort of a name she had made for herself. To me, she was my mom. I remember when I was a postdoc, somebody introduced me, you know, this is Alan Rubin, his mother discovered dark matter, and I turned to him and I said, no, she didn't. And it's because it was, you know, it really taking me, I grew up, you know, I'm a scientist, and most things in scientists are not discovered by one person. And in fact, dark matter was not discovered by one person. But that was my initial response, that she's not the discoverer of dark matter. She's my mother.
How do you think she saw herself, both as a scientist who did big things and also as a woman who did amazing things, especially in making a path for other women?
What she most liked to do was observe the heavens. That was certainly much more important to her than, you know, whether she got this award or that award. Trying to make the paths for the next generation of women astronomers easier, that was also a big part of what she did. I suspect she was prouder of that. That took a little more guts. I think she recognized that she had some responsibility to push for women scientists as well, but maybe a little more reluctantly at first.
I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me, and I also want to say I'm very sorry for your loss.
Well, thank you.
Alan Rubin is a professor of geology at Princeton University, and the woman he described as just his mom, Vera Rubin, proved the existence of dark matter. She died in December.
The lesson that I, you know, wished I learned from her, and maybe I've learned, but to a much lesser extent, you know, if you see what you want, just go out and do it.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about challenging our assumptions, and our next story takes us to the emergency room. In this fast-paced setting, doctors have to make quick decisions that are often based on their experience and their assumptions. For example, should they prescribe heavy-duty pain medications to a patient, or would that do them more harm than good? The stakes are high. Thousands of Americans die from overdosing on prescription drugs every year, so doctors are cutting back, especially on opioids. But the question is, when do they cut back, and does race impact their decisions? Reporter Dori Buscarin has this story about patients affected by a debilitating genetic disease.
When Tangela Bolden Myers had knee surgery, she went to her pharmacy for a narcotic to bring down the swelling and ran into trouble. The pharmacist didn't want to fill her prescription because Bolden Myers had gotten Vicodin the week before.
I don't take the Vicodin like that, but they don't know me to know that. I'm like, the Vicodin I have locked in a safe for when I need it.
Vicodin helps her manage sickle cell anemia, a blood condition that causes severe pain episodes. Occasionally, Bolden Myers has to go to the emergency room for heavier medications and fluids for dehydration. But if she's at an unfamiliar ER, she says it seems like the doctors assume she's addicted to painkillers and faking the pain to get the medicine.
I have had to title drop, name drop, to say that I have this degree and that degree and I'm a certified trade counselor, and I'm in tears or I'm crying or I'm screaming or I'm rocking and moaning or all of these things together, and you just want to assume that I'm drug seeking.
There's no blood test to prove you're in pain. There's no measurement, no objective proof. I met 7 sickle cell patients in St. Louis, and all but one said they had been accused of pill-seeking when they were going through a pain crisis. A 2010 review found that people with sickle cell disease waited almost twice as long as patients with kidney stones in the emergency room, even though they rated their pain higher on a 1 to 10 scale. Hematologist Allison King at Washington University in St. Louis says this is happening even though sickle cell patients are just about as likely to abuse opioids as anyone else. The patients she sees are often poor and Black, and King says stereotypes about what an addict looks like can affect a doctor's judgment.
So if you imagine that I'm a 20-year-old Black male who comes into the ER and I say, I have sickle cell anemia, I usually need, 3 milligrams of Dilaudid a couple times to get my pain under control, the default is this is a young black kid looking for drugs.
But the reality is, white people are the fastest growing demographic of opioid abusers. Among all drug overdose deaths in 2014, over 80% were white. I went to a local emergency room to speak with doctors about how they decide who gets drugs and who doesn't. After all, they're the ones who risk losing their license if they overprescribe. Paul Pfeiffer heads the emergency department at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital, a nonprofit Catholic medical center in St. Louis.
You know, I do think sometimes we have a tendency not to give pain medications because I think there's, you know, this thought that, you know, that we do have a lot of seekers.
In every U.S. state except for Missouri, doctors have a computer database where they can look up how many prescriptions a patient has filled. The monitoring system can alert a physician if a patient is doctor shopping, going to multiple places to get pills. But Missouri doesn't have a database like this. The opposition comes from a prominent state legislator who argues it's a violation of personal privacy. So the decision to prescribe narcotics, Pfeiffer says, becomes a judgment call.
They don't have a tattoo right up on their forehead says I'm seeking, but I think you can, you know, you see the personality, the way they respond to some suggestions on what you're going to do, and some become irate or they're just inappropriate. You know that there are some addictive patterns.
Since the opioid crisis, many emergency rooms have established policies to reduce the number of doses doctors prescribe. But pain management experts argue that putting doctors in this situation doesn't work. One patient advocate told me that even seasoned crime investigators have a hard time discerning a lie. What makes us think doctors can do it? Sickle cell patients who feel stereotyped say they stick together for support. They swap phone numbers and drive to the emergency room together if a friend is going through a crisis. And they vouch for each other.
But I just want to thank you all for joining us.
Each month, patients and family members gather around tables at the Sickle Cell Association office in St. Louis. The day I visited, there were plates of nachos to share, and a few more people called in to listen through the speakerphone.
I'm brought to this meeting because I love being around people like myself.
My daughter is six, so everything that we're learning about is through trial and error.
The group talks about ways to navigate a visit to the emergency room. Erica Green leads the discussion. She's lived with sickle cell for 45 years. She says, above all, try to stay calm despite the pain.
Because you tend to get better care when you're respectful, when you know how to conduct yourselves, and when you have a problem in the ER, what steps to take to get those things rectified.
It's unlikely Missouri will catch up with the rest of the country and implement a statewide drug database soon. But the need is so great that several counties have agreed to create one of their own at the local level. Patients say that could help them prove they aren't abusing opioids, but it's a small step towards challenging the stereotype. For The Pulse, I'm Duri Buscarin.
Duri is a health and science reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Sometimes when we make decisions or assumptions about people, we're not even aware of our own biases. Scientists call this unconscious bias. I talked to Harvard psychologist Mahzarin Banaji. Her book is Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. She's also part of Project Implicit, which educates people about hidden biases. And she told me treatment disparities in medicine are by no means unique to sickle cell anemia.
Race differences occur in everything that we can see. Routine medical procedures, cardiac medication, bypass surgery, dialysis, kidney transplant. The first question, of course, that most people naturally go to is that doctors just don't like black patients, that they have some explicit or conscious prejudice that leads them to treat black patients differently. And that's where our work comes in, to say a very clear no. Why do we think it's not conscious bias? Because it turns out that race differences actually go away when you present with a condition that is very visible, like a laceration. And in those cases, we don't see race biases because we believe that when it's visible, it can go away. But when a doctor has to infer what is happening inside of a patient's body or inside of a patient's mind, that's where race differences do emerge, and that's where we believe implicit bias is playing a role.
where does this implicit bias come from? How do we develop that? How do we learn it?
We use the term blind spot, just as our eyes have a blind spot where information can't be detected. We believe that our brains have several of these blind spots that have to do with our inability to be able to accurately ascertain the cause of something or to figure out why somebody's doing what they're doing. And we use our stereotypes about different groups to fill in the blanks. They come from us by the architecture of how our minds are built through evolution. They come from our culture. And together, they lead us to make assumptions about why the person in front of us is doing what they're doing.
So how do you fix this? What do you do? How do you train people?
Strong awareness, and not awareness by just saying you might be biased. Awareness that is given to medical professionals through evidence of their own hospitals. I think every hospital system should be required to compute disparities across many different domains, many different diseases, but across many different groupings, not just race, but age and income and so on. And those data, I believe, should be required for professionals to see. I believe that when the doctor types in the name of any pain medication, that a little graph should be presented to them that shows them the race disparity in their hospital system that they have observed over a long period of time. They should show them the distribution of the milligrams of a medication that is being prescribed on average, let's say to white men versus black men, if the person presenting is a black man or a white man. And that data in the moment of prescribing, I believe, will deeply affect the doctor.
Now, earlier I went on the Project Implicit website and I took a test. It's called an implicit association test. You were one of the people who helped develop this test. And I took a test on race and I had to very quickly hit different keys on my keyboard for association, good, bad. I was being shown different faces, white faces, African-American faces. And in the end, the test said I had a slight bias where I was favoring European Americans. And it's painful. It's painful to be told that.
It is painful. It is confusing. It is humbling when you eventually recognize it. I have had to come face to face with my own bias. And I did so in the mid-1990s. When I took the race test, which was the first test I took, my first response was, the test is screwed up. There's something about this test that's wrong. That's how deeply skeptical I was about a test invented in my own science using methods I was extremely familiar with. And then a few seconds later, when I tried the test in a variety of different ways and my score wouldn't budge, that's when I realized it's not the test that's screwed up. It's my head that's screwed up. And it's because I carry the thumbprint of the culture on my brain, and I had better become aware of that.
What do I do with this result now? Or what does anybody do when we take such a test and it turns out we do carry these biases?
I think taking the test is important. I think knowing where you stand, roughly speaking, is important. Once you know that you have the bias, I think you have to be on a journey, because this is not a one-moment fix. The good thing about these biases is that you don't need to spend huge amounts of money to fix it or do it in one big swoop. You just need to do it in little bits every single day. Think about it very much like exercising. And one of the first things to do is to be skeptical of your own choices. When I look at two candidates for a job and I have to pick one and I love one and I don't love the other so much, I have to ask myself, why? Do I like this one because she and I went to the same high school? Or do I like this one because she looks like me? I think we will, first of all, begin to shape our own behaviors. And human beings are wonderful at this, right? We have come to become such different people over these several millennia that I have great optimism that when we understand that we will change our behavior.
Mahzarin Banaji is a psychologist and a researcher at Harvard. Her book is Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about challenging our assumptions. Let's say somebody tells you about a crazy disease that turns out to be totally fake, and you're a doctor. Maybe your first impulse is to say, that's ridiculous, that doesn't exist. Or there's another option. Challenge yourself to turn this into a moment of connection. Physician Anita Ravi talked about such a moment during a recent Story Slam.
The first time I heard about blue waffle disease, I was standing on the fifth floor of the women's jail in Rikers Island. I was doing a weekly health education workshop, and as we were wrapping up, somebody raised their hand and they said, hey, doc, by the way, do you know if we have a cure for blue waffle disease yet? So I remember standing there, I remember thinking, oh my God, I have never heard of blue waffle disease. I just finished residency, how did I miss this? I'm $250,000 in debt, and I have nothing to show for it. So I decided to do my, I own it, and did my what is a LEPO moment, and I was just sad. And what is blue waffle disease? So I was like, okay, I am gonna look into this. I will be back next week and tell you about it, because I could feel my credibility kind of like vanishing from the jail cells. And so I was back taking the bus out of Rikers Island, pulled out my phone. Pro tip, never start looking about blue waffle disease under Google image, because it is very nasty. So I did a deep dive into research in what is blue waffle disease, and I learned two really interesting things. The first is that it's an STD, a sexually transmitted disease, that only affects women. And basically what it does is it causes the vagina to turn blue. The second thing I learned is that it is an well-known elaborate internet hoax with somebody who has extensive, beautiful photoshopping skills. But not a lot of us knew that. So what I did was I was like, this is great. I went back the next week and I was like, everybody, blue waffle disease is not a thing. We don't have to worry about it. And it was amazing because people are like, oh, we didn't know. We were wondering about that. A few people were still skeptical. But what I did was every other health education group that I did, I just started proactively asking about blue waffle disease. And people would, you know, people would voice their concerns about it. I started asking about it in clinical settings, and everything changes. The dynamics shift because all of a sudden it's like you're speaking in code. It's scary to think that there are things that people worry about that they may be afraid to ask about, and that we don't even know about it, so we don't think to ask about it. That's a blue waffle in medicine. When you think about it, we try to bridge that gap in different ways, right? Sometimes we'll take our white coats off, we sit eye level with people, we try to show different ways to connect, and asking about blue waffle turned out to be another way to be able to connect with people. Around the time, I was starting a clinic for survivors of sex trafficking. So I went back to Rikers Island to be able to kind of discover the blue waffles of sex trafficking and understanding what people cared about. One of the main things I learned was that the biggest thing that the trafficker is looking for is a profit from the human body. So what they would say is, you have quotas to meet. And if you don't meet your daily quotas, guess what? There are consequences. There were very violent consequences that people shared. One thing that kept coming up was stuffing. People were worried about stuffing. So another blue waffle moment. I said, well, what is stuffing? And so people talked about this experience that they had where they still had to meet their quotas, but during the time where they were having their period, what people would talk about was inserting baby wipes or makeup rounds into the vagina to absorb blood so that they wouldn't lose out their quota, they wouldn't have to face the consequences of this. The thing that scared people was that it was really hard to get those objects out. And that actually is what led people to go to the ER. And I started thinking about those times when I'd rotate through the ER and you look and you see these chief complaints that say, oh, foreign body, you know, lodged in there. And we're like, how did that get in there? And we don't, you know, and we don't know. And when you don't know, you don't think to ask about those things or think to consider that that could be a situation that's going on. So learning about stuffing ended up being very important, because then every week in clinic, when I would hear these stories, I could go back and ask, like, so, you know, what are you worried about? Are you stuffing? And that, again, was that blue waffle moment. It shifts the dynamics. It's a code way of saying, this is a safe space, we can talk about it, and it's not stigma, it's support. So when I think about it, blue waffle disease is probably one of the most important diseases I've learned as a physician, I've learned about. And when you think about treating it, the only way to be able to treat blue waffle disease is to be able to make the diagnosis of it. So thank you.
That was Anita Ravi during a story slam hosted by The Pulse and the Annals of Internal Medicine. Ravi is a family physician, and she started a primary care clinic in New York for victims of sex trafficking. Coming up, when you think you're going to be an opera singer and then you fall in love with geology.
I remember talking to this tour guide on this glacier hike about why the ice was blue and what happened, like the way it interacted with the light. And that was just like the best conversation I had all summer.
Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Physicians and clinicians who diagnose or play a role in supporting patients with cancer are invited to a half-day oncology CME event on Saturday, February 4th. Details at ctcaforum.org. That's ctcaforum.org.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about challenging our assumptions. Peter Godfrey Smith wants us to reconsider what we think about octopuses. Yes, that is the correct plural. I actually looked it up. In his new book, Other Minds, he says engaging with octopuses is probably the closest thing we have to meeting an intelligent alien. How so? Because their minds are complex, yet so very different from ours. Our last common evolutionary ancestor was a simple worm-like being that lived 600 million years ago. Godfrey Smith calls octopuses an independent experiment in the evolution of the mind, and I asked him to explain how we know that they have complex brains.
For a long time, people have suspected that octopuses in captivity could recognize and behave differently towards individual humans. So they knew this human from that human and would make distinctions between them. And they found that octopuses could indeed, as people had suspected, remember individual humans and behave differently in response to them. This was a surprising finding in a lot of ways. Firstly, octopuses are not very social animals. They don't have any particular reason to be good at recognizing individuals, even of their own species in most cases, let alone humans. So the idea that they could track and behave differently towards individual humans was really quite surprising. It shows how complicated they are.
What were some assumptions that maybe you had about cephalopods that you had to challenge, or about your idea of what constitutes a mind or a conscious being, as you got to know this species better?
So one of the big facts about octopuses is they have large nervous systems, but the majority of their neurons are not found where you'd expect to find them, sort of in the head, between the eyes, as you would with a human. But instead, most of the neurons are found spread through the body, especially within the arms themselves. And with respect to the control of basic motions, at least, the arms of an octopus seem to have some degree of autonomy. They're able to sort of make their own way. So when you think about our experience, when you think about human experience, it's very natural to think in terms of a kind of a definite self, a kind of center for the mental life that we all have. And it's hard to even think about what it might be like to be a kind of, far more decentralized or distributed kind of intelligence. And that's one of the ways in which octopuses they really sort of probe our thinking about the nature of the mind.
When you study cephalopods, how do you make sure you don't anthropomorphize them in some way? I mean, as a human, we're always looking for a mind that is something like ours, because that's all we know.
So it's true that there's this possibility of anthropomorphizing and thinking that they're too similar to us. I think it's also the case that there's been a tendency in some parts of biology of so rigorously avoiding anthropomorphizing that the animals in a way get kind of undersold. But recent work in behavioral biology has found quite a lot of sense in the idea that animals do differ with respect to what could be called personality. So the distinction between shy individuals and bold individuals, individuals prone to a kind of stressful response to things and others that are not, they often show a kind of curiosity about humans. They often sort of reach out an arm to explore a human who might be in front of their den. To some extent, this is probably an attempt to work out whether this thing in front of them might be edible. But it's been shown that octopuses have a kind of curious interest in things that they pretty clearly know they can't eat. So they're just very exploratory and inquisitive animals. And I think of this as a point of real similarity between us and them.
What do you feel when you're in the presence of cephalopods, of an octopus? What crosses your mind?
I spend quite a bit of time just trying to work out what might be going on inside them.
Do you ever get the sense they are doing the same with you, wondering what you're up to?
When you put it like that, you know, it's probably too much to ask to think of them as sort of wondering in the particular way a person does. But they're certainly watchful and curious in their orientation towards humans. And you can think of it as a kind of at least a faint analog of the same kind of interest. There is certainly a kind of mutual engagement. You know, they're engaged with keeping an eye on you and trying to determine what kind of being you are, just as you're doing something similar with them.
Peter Godfrey-Smith is a professor of philosophy. His new book is Other Minds, The Octopus, The Sea, and The Deep Origins of Consciousness. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. On our show today, we're challenging our assumptions. What did you want to be when you were a kid? Most of us go through some kind of progression, maybe from fireman to rock star to astronaut, and then eventually we arrive at accountant or lawyer. And at any age, what we think is a great profession is based on our assumptions of what makes for a rewarding career. Emily Stewart grew up dreaming of being a singer, bright lights, performing West Side Story, but then she stumbled onto something else.
I wanted to be on Broadway. That's what I wanted to do. But there's this woman from my hometown, from Huntsville, Alabama, who's an incredible opera singer, and she would give these recitals in this little church in my hometown. You very rarely have an opportunity to sit kind of that close to someone of that caliber and hear something that intimate. And it was the first time I'd ever been moved to tears in like a happy way. I mean, it was unbelievable. It's a religious experience, you know, it's just something else, something transcendent. I was probably 15 years old when I decided, you know, forget Broadway, I'm gonna be an opera singer instead. I went to Indiana and started taking voice lessons and doing that whole thing. The Jacobs School of Music at Indiana is the number one voice program in the country. It's like pretty competitive and people are pretty insane there. It was a pretty cutthroat atmosphere that I wasn't crazy about. So that summer, rather than staying and practicing, I decided to drive to Alaska. They say like every time you access a memory, you actually change it a little bit. And I access this one a lot. So maybe it wasn't as wonderful as I remember it being, but I'm pretty sure it was incredible. I'm pretty sure.
I think that's the 78th
counter. In Alaska, you've got glaciery mountain peaks and there's this plant called lupin, I think, that's this beautiful purple flower. And then later in the summer, you get fireweed, which only shows up for a short amount of time, but it's this bright kind of red. Yeah, I don't think I can overstate how beautiful it was. It's beyond exhilarating. I remember talking to this tour guide on this glacier hike about why the ice was blue and what happened, like the way it interacted with the light. And that was just like the best conversation I had all summer. And I realized that I hadn't gotten to think about that kind of stuff when I was a singer. I didn't really think about anything. I think there's a kind of fundamental lack of curiosity in becoming a musician. You're not really thinking about the world. You're not really thinking about anything except how to like hone this particular technical skill that you have, and there's really no room for curiosity. So there's this science museum And I went there once before work to, like, kill time and watched this documentary about scientists taking these boats out to this island to, like, tag foxes. That sounds really stupid, but I just started, like, sobbing, like, watching this, because the idea of being, like, a scientist, it just looked, like, so much more amazing than the life that I felt like I was going back to. That was the point when I, like, really kind of admitted to myself that I didn't want to go back to doing music at all. Yeah. I'd never taken a geology class. I remember going back to school and I was calling up my mom on this payphone in the library and saying, like, I think I'm going to change to a geology major. And she's like, why don't you just, like, take some geology classes and, like, stay in the music school? And that was kind of, like, the normal response. I think most people were pretty horrified. But I knew I couldn't go back to being a musician. That was not an option. So I think maybe the undertow that's been running through this story is that I was raised an atheist, and I've always been an atheist, and so you kind of have to find meaning in other things, and for a while I think music was that kind of transcendent aspect of life. But it's only recently that I've started thinking of geology as actually having some spiritual aspect to it. It allows for, like, a view of the universe that isn't so, like, human-centric. You know, you get to think about things on millions and billion-year timescales, and that's really fun. So I guess I've been a geologist now for 6 years, and I've gotten to do some really cool stuff. I just finished up my master's degree trying to figure out how old particular microstructures in rocks are. Last summer, I went to Spain and, like, hiked around in the mountains and picked up rocks. This weekend, I went to this field conference where I was just tromping around Connecticut in the woods looking at rocks and talking to people about them. I've traveled to Newfoundland, all over New England, Spain, California. Yeah, looking at things and thinking about things. And it's been really great. It's been really great so far. But if there's anything that I learned in all of this, it's that people just kind of do something and that maybe you're never actually doing the right thing. So yeah, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing, but I think I don't have the kind of angst associated with, like, doing the exact right thing anymore. I'm just kind of enjoying things, and maybe I could be happy doing a ton of other stuff.
That's Emily Stewart telling her story of becoming a scientist. The original version aired on the podcast Out There, which explores big questions in the great outdoors. David Waters produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. This week, we also welcome Elizabeth Fiedler to our reporting team, and she's already sending me intriguing cat videos. Stay tuned. Alex Stern is our intern, Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, we're going to visit a shut-down coal mine with a man who worked there.
I feel good sitting right here. I do. I've got chills. This is where I spent my life. And, you know, I'm proud of my coal mining days. I really enjoyed it.
What if coal made a comeback? And other stories of changing political tides. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.